First of all, I thank the organizers for inviting me and be speaking, sort of continuing on David's talk on looking at dynamics as well as soil properties and soil states. And so today I'll be introducing the cosmic ray neutron probe in a bit here. I just want to give a little bit more on some thoughts, some of the things we've been up to and thinking about in our lab group. So the one thing is really keeping our eye on the prize. So in the Midwest, we really think a lot about the aquifer and how sustainable we can make this land use system. So this is some nice recent diagrams looking at long-term trends in water levels across the continental United States and some of these declining trends. And so the real point is, how do we take our observations of things like soil moisture and turn those into value-added products like recharge or understanding something about the aquifer system? So three sort of take-home messages, and then you can stop paying attention if you'd like, is that, like we've heard from other speakers, is that when we start to get into these high-resolution hydrological and biogeochemical models, is they're really plagued by poor soil parameterization and updates of soil states and time and space. And so as David spoke about, it's hydrogeophysics offers us some additional spatial data sets, certainly at a cost and time and effort and money, to really help us better resolve soil states and properties, and I'll give some examples of that later on in the presentation. And finally, as we've also heard today, is we need to come up with frameworks on how we combine different products, either that be in situ information, proximal or remote sensing, to merge this information into a seamless product in space and time. And so I'll present one framework of what we've been doing with in situ sensors and sampling with some of the geophysics. So as we talked heard today already, is that ecosystems are really an organization of climate, topography, vegetation, and soil, and really this is a scale-dependent process. So we need to be thinking about the interactions of these various components and how they lead to these emergent properties in these systems. And so if we think about just soil moisture and connecting our state observation of water content with fluxes, is we can come up with very simple parameterizations of this process. And so we can look at the standard bucket model where we relate the soil state and some of the fluxes. So we have different parameterizations that go into that, like field capacity, wilting point, and how those are affected by the water content over the rooting profile. And so we can get into more complex mathematics and physics, and we can start to look at the Richards equation and really what drives these processes of gravity and capillarity. And so what really comes down to are a set of boundary conditions, our physical representation, and some of the parameters inside of this model. So if we think of the water retention curves, we really can break this down into four key hydraulic properties, N, alpha, bulk density, and saturated hydraulic conductivity. So how do we get from soil properties to parameters? Classic way is to take our soil texture diagram, sand, silt, clay, organic material, and convert that into these physical parameters. And so this is a representation of the soil texture diagram. However, when you start to look at Richards' equation and some of these solutions, is when you start to think about hydraulic conductivity or infiltration and drainage, is those boundaries necessarily don't line up with the soil texture diagram. And so we have some mismatch between what we can observe and our soil properties and what we actually want are the soil fluxes and the parameters that control those fluxes. And so this was an interesting study that Gray Nearing led a couple of years ago, where he looked at the NLDAS product versus existing soil moisture sensors and eddy covariance towers, and he compared the NLDAS product with these observations across the continental United States. And so what Gray found using some information theory is, where is our loss of information in this system? So a bit complex here, but as you start as a full amount of information on the left diagram, is you add processes to this. So first we can add our boundary conditions and we can look at our loss of information. We can next add our parameters. Again, we have more loss of information. And then finally, we can look at our physical representation of the mathematics. And again, we lose some information. And the interesting thing in this diagram is when we look at adding for soil moisture, is when we look at adding parameters, is we lose about half of our information between what we can model versus what our observations were across the continental United States. And so this is really what I base this claim on, is that we're really, these models are plagued by this poor soil parameterization that we heard from our first talk today. All right, so what are some of the answers to this? First is we can use light and radiation to take observations across this wavelength. So we've heard a little bit today about the visible and near infrared, but really there's this whole range of wavelengths that we can take advantage. So today I'll be talking about cosmic rays, which are really, you know, this 10 to the minus 12 meters. And we've also heard some talks today about radar and other types of information. So we really have this sort of 24 orders of magnitude of light or radiation to look at these different features. And so this is what astrophysicists have done, is they put up a constellation of telescopes in orbiting the Earth, and they can look at features like the Crab Nebula or other galactic areas of interest. And they can look at these different wavelengths and come up with an understanding of what that what is made of and how is it connected in space. And so I think we have an opportunity with these various sensors to combine different wavelengths of light and radiation to come up with a better understanding of space and time. And so this one additional source that we'll talk about is the Cosmic Ray Probe. Again, it has very low wavelength. I'm not going to get into too many of the details, but this is what the detector looks like. So the top middle diagram shows a stationary probe that measures neutron counts about every hour, and we convert that into soil moisture over a 200-meter radius and about the top 30 centimeters of soil. And we also have a mobile detector, which can get neutron counts every minute, and so we can drive it around and make spatial maps in agricultural fields or across landscapes if we want to get up to remote sensing pixels. And so right now there's about 200 of these cosmic ray sensors operating around the Earth in various continents. There's a big project in the UK right now, in Germany. And so if you're interested, there's a nice review paper that just came out on the technique. And so how it works is we basically measure the amount of neutron counts or energy over a spectrum, and that changes with the amount of water that's added to the system or amount of hydrogen. Again, happy to chat more details later on. And so what are we doing with this technique? Is one is we can look at things like irrigation scheduling. So this is just two cosmic ray observations. The top graph shows a irrigated field where we have the green and red lines are the field capacity and wilting point. And so if you're doing a good job of irrigating, is you want to keep your soil moisture about halfway between the red and green lines. And the lower graph shows a dry land pixel where we see some of the water stress occurring in this part of western Nebraska. And so one thing is if you want to irrigation scheduling, is this potentially one method to give you that real-time information. The other things that we're looking at are spatial properties. So this is another site in central Nebraska where we have seven different surgo zones, a nice elevation gradient. And so we picked this as sort of a site with lots of variability to look at what is the information in this actual detector. And so here's some imagery. So we did an EC map, like David was talking about. We also did a series of cosmic ray images. Each of these took about an hour to collect on an ATV. And then the lower diagram just shows the stationary cosmic ray probe going up and down over the season and when we collect this spatial information. So we have some time-lapse geophysics. So now the next question is, what do we do with that information? And so one thing that we've tried to reconcile is what is the actual spatial information content in some of these repeat observations. And so one method we're using is called empirical orthogonal functions. It's very similar to principal component analysis, but it splits your variability and your coefficients into time and space, and then you multiply those back together and you can reconstruct the image. So it's a very useful technique when combined with proximal sensing. And so we did this with our 10 images of cosmic ray information, and we found that about 90% of the spatial variability for this particular field could be described in one set of coefficients. So now instead of having, you know, 10 time-lapse images of soil moisture, is we now have one set of coefficients that we can use as a covariate to make spatial predictions. And so that's what my student Katie did. She went out and collected a series of soil cores where we measured the water retention functions across this particular field, and we looked at what is the best spatial predictor of soil properties. So this is the HiProp setup that you see. Some of you probably worked with it, a nice simple device to get water retention functions. This is what some of the data looks like. So you get a lot of information at the wet end, and then at the drier end of the curve, you have to use a different instrument, a W4PC, to get your wilting point information. And so we can start to look at the scatter diagram of, all right, let's take our estimates of wilting point and field capacity and available water and compare those to different spatial covariates like elevation, wetness index, the EC imagery, and then this cosmic ray EOF time-lapse sort of a feature. And what we found is that basically by combining elevation and the EOF from the cosmic rays, is we had a pretty good spatial predictor in terms of predicting what we got in the laboratory. And so you can start to make spatial products that are then useful for making irrigation decisions. So this is a full variable rate system. So we provided a field capacity and wilting point map to now turn that into an actual prescription map for this particular producer. So when we start to think about long-term stability of the aquifer, is this the idea of reduction in pumping and what amount of effort we want to put in for this particular type of crop, particular land use, and particular setup. And so we can use this the Sirgo information, which is a great first step, but we can start to add more information like EC mapping, potentially time-lapse EC and cosmic ray to gain more insight about the spatial processes. That's one last quick study as we wanted to further extend this to a different site in Nebraska. This is Justin Gibson's work. And so here we were looking at, all right, what are our predictions of using things like Sirgo plus Rosetta for our pitot transfer functions, and to see what is our best environmental covariate, how we use that as our benchmark versus the in situ samples. So we picked three fields in western Nebraska, all 160 acres, and we did a series of geophysical surveys, about four to five in each of these fields. So the white boundaries show the Sirgo zones, and then the color maps show the geophysicals. So the Sirgo zones are pretty good, but you certainly get some offset information on where the Sirgo boundaries are compared to what you get with the geophysics. So when it comes to precision agriculture, that makes a huge difference for this particular field in the economics. And so you can look at all the different retention functions. We did about 20 retention functions in each of these three fields. And so that's shown on the left is just the variability that you get in retention functions. And then you can start to map that onto different surfaces. So the top one is the cosmic ray EOF. The middle one is the electroconductivity EOF. And the bottom one is just a relative elevation as a general predictor. And so you get some separation of the water retention functions depending on sort of the different environmental covariate. All right, so this is a complex slide, so I'll take you through it quick. Is we wanted to, again, figure out what is the information content. And so we did a cross-validation study where we trained our algorithm, say using three or five samples, and predicted our remaining 15 and looked at our, what is our root mean squared error between our prediction and our unsampled sites. And so the left series of diagrams shows bulk density, N, alpha, and Ksat versus a cross-validation study using a different products like the EC, cosmic ray, and elevation. And so some take-home messages, basically we found that 5 to 7 samples in these three fields basically was our diminishing return on the amount of spatial information. And so we could do 5 to 7 samples based off the geophysics and have a pretty good understanding of the spatial variability where we no longer got reduction in that RMSE. And so we compare this to standard sampling at 2.5 acre grids, and you take 5 samples versus about 60 if you're looking at soil fertility, is that's a huge reduction in potential sampling effort based off of using a geophysics alone. And so let's, I guess my suggestion is let's use some of that cost in collecting fewer samples, but investing in some of the geophysical surveys ahead of time. In terms of predicting these individual Van Gennuchten parameters, as we found that with, compared to Cerro Rosetta, we got about a 40 to 90% reduction in bulk density in N. However, not as much information was in alpha and KSAT. And we think that's just because of the nature of how we collected the data, is we're only able to collect EC and cosmic ray data in dry and medium soils, and so we were really missing that wet part of the actual moisture distribution. And so moving forward is we really want to combine this with visible, maybe UAS systems to really get that wet range and to see if we can describe that variability right after a rain or irrigation event. So take-home message is really we're finding that using bootstrapping methods is about four geophysical surveys allows us to really describe the soil moisture variability using this EOF framework. And so we're now working with a couple of different companies to collect this information more quickly and inexpensively by using, you know, self-driving cars, existing farm equipment, to potentially reduce the cost and labor of this system. In terms of this EOF framework, again, we found about for these three fields of 5 to 7 samples was plenty to describe the spatial variability when we combine that with the geophysics. And if we start to think about things like other additional AI or deep learning algorithms, is that this cosmic ray information we think is fundamentally different information because of the wavelength that it collects that at. So it's a good when we combine this with other sensors or proximal sensing or satellites, it's going to be a good discriminator of information content. Finally, is when we get into actual products, it's very nice to combine these with soil cores that we do in a laboratory or commercial labs to start to generate some of these useful spatial products where you can make a decision. Anyways, that's it. I'm happy to take any questions. Yes. Yep. So certainly the EC will be able to capture that variability. The cosmic ray probe doesn't have fine as a footprint, so it really has to do with the length scale of that heterogeneity.